And also the topic that I'm going to talk about today, which is about gravitational waves from the early universe. This is also something that I already briefly talked about in the internal cosmology discussion, so some of you may have already heard about it. But the reason why I decided to talk about this topic today is because, first of all, I think this is a rather simple story. So it's something that I can actually do the computations on the blackboard within an hour. And also, I think this topic is rather timely in the sense that we're actually expecting to hear about observational data on these primordial gravitational waves sometime during this year. Okay, so my talk is going to be, it's based on this paper which I've written in collaboration with Tomo Takahashi from Japan. Okay, so last year was an exciting year for cosmology with the Planck data release. But those data, the release data was basically about the temperature fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. But this year, the Planck team is supposed to release further data about the polarization data of the CMB. And what's so cool about the CMB polarization data is that it can tell us a lot about the primordial gravitational waves, I mean the gravity waves produced during cosmic inflation. And this is because these gravity waves, these are basically the tensor mode fluctuations of the space-time metric. And these tensor fluctuations, they produce specific polarization patterns in the CMB, which are something called the B-mode polarizations. So by searching for those B-mode polarization signals, you can either indirectly detect or put upper bounds on the primordial gravitational waves. And not just the Planck satellite, but there's also a lot of polarization experiments that are planned for the next decade or two, basically trying to lower the upper bound on the primordial gravitational waves. And for these primordial gravitational waves, there's a very interesting relationship that is known to hold between the amplitude of the gravity waves and the microphysics of inflation, namely that the amplitude of the primordial gravitational waves is known to be bounded from above by the inflaton field excursion, the field range that the inflaton field has to move during inflation. And this relation was first proposed by Leith, so it's often referred to as the Leith bound. But what this Leith bound basically tells us is that in order for the early universe, I mean, in order for an inflation to produce gravitational waves at a level that can be detected by us in the near future, then you necessarily need a super Planckian inflaton field range. And this is actually a very strong constraint because, first of all, it's difficult, if not impossible, to have an inflationary theory where you have good control of the inflationary theory over super Planckian, Planckian field ranges. And also from the model building point of view, this Leith bound very strongly restricts the inflationary models that can produce large gravitational waves to a very small class of models. It restricts the model space to a very small class of models of these super Planckian large field inflation models. So it's a very strong constraint. But what I'm going to point out today is that this Leith bound is not necessarily true. Well, to be a little bit more precise, I'm going to point out that when there's physical degrees of freedom in addition to the inflaton, then in some there exist some special cases where the inflaton field can give away its Leith bound to this other non-inflaton sector. So in this sense, the Leith bound still holds for the total field space. However, this opens up the possibility of producing observably large gravitational waves even from small field inflation models. So in other words, if the Planck satellite or any of the upcoming CMB polarization experiments, if they detect some hint if they detect the primordial gravitational waves, then the message is that that does not necessarily mean that the inflaton was super Planckian. It's a sign of a super Planckian something, but not necessarily the inflaton field. Okay, so that's what I'm going to try to address in the next hour or so. So first of all, I'm going to start by giving a brief review of the Leith bound, why it holds and all that. And then I'll move to the main part where I'm going to explain how you can actually evade this Leith bound. And I'm going to also present an explicit early universe example where this evasion of the Leith bound happens necessarily. Okay? So let me start by reviewing the Leith bound. So the Leith bound can be understood by considering the scalar and the tensor perturbations produced during cosmic inflation. So for the scalar perturbations, in other words, the density perturbations, these are the perturbations that are considered to be the source of the CMB temperature fluctuations and also all the rich structure we see in our universe today. So the density perturbations are produced from the field fluctuation of the inphoton field. And the basic picture is that in a De Sitter spacetime, basically all sorts of almost free fields obtain superposing field fluctuations of order of the Hubble parameter. So also, the inphoton field also has these Hubble-sized field fluctuations. And what this means is that in some patch of the universe, the inphoton field is, the position of the inphoton field can be slightly different from other patches of the universe. And this inphoton field is, by definition, it's the field that drives inflation as it rolls along its effective potential. So in a patch of the universe where the inphoton field is slightly behind the average means that in that patch of the universe, inflation can last a little bit longer. And in other patches of the universe, if the inphoton field is slightly ahead of the average, that means that inflation would end a little bit faster. So therefore, if this inphoton field fluctuates, that means that the duration of inflation becomes slightly different among different patches of the universe. So at the end of inflation, you end up with some amount of density perturbations. So that's how it works. So if you want to compute the power spectrum of the scalar perturbations, which I denote by P of zeta, this is proportional to some power of the inflationary Hubble parameter, because the field fluctuations of the inphoton field is set by the Hubble parameter. And in the denominator comes the inphoton velocity. And this is because if the inphoton velocity is tiny, it means that the field fluctuations translate into larger time difference in the duration of inflation among different patches of the universe. So that's why the inphoton velocity comes in the denominator. Now for the tensor perturbations, in other words, these are the gravitation waves from the early universe. These are produced similarly from the field fluctuation of the graviton field. So if you want to compute its power spectrum, the P, which I denote by P of t, this is also set by some power of the Hubble parameter. But this is totally a gravitational effect. So this is suppressed by the Planck scale instead of the inphoton velocity. So these are the power spectra of the tensor and the scalar. I mean, the gravitational waves and the density perturbations. And when we want to parameterize the amplitude of the gravitational waves, the useful quantity that we often consider is the ratio between the tensor and the scalar perturbations, because we already know the amplitude of the scalar perturbations from the CMB experiments. So the tensor to scalar ratio is defined as the power spectra. It's defined as the ratio between the power spectra. And so by substituting these relations, you can basically compute the ratio. Thank you. Yeah, the tensor to scalar ratio. OK? So then you get something like this. So now, by using this relation, you can basically compute the inphoton field excursion in terms of the tensor to scalar ratio. So the inphoton field excursion, delta phi, is basically just the inphoton velocity multiplied by the duration of inflation. And if I add an extra Hubble parameter here like this, okay, then this part, the h multiplied by delta t, is just basically the delta of the log of the scale factor. So this is just this just corresponds to the e-folding number during inflation. And here, this the inphoton velocity over the Hubble parameter can be given in terms of the tensor to scalar ratio. So if you substitute this relation here, you can compute the tensor the inphoton field excursion, which looks like this. So this is the life bound. So for example, if you put in a typical value for the e-folding number during inflation, which is something like 50, and the current upper bound on this tensor to scalar ratio is something like 0.1, okay, then in this case, I think you can see that delta phi will be something like 10 times the Planck scale. And the upcoming CMB polarization experiments that are planned for the next decade or two, they claim that they can lower the upper bound on R down to something like 10 to the power of minus 3 or minus 4. But anyway, I think you can see from this length bound that in order for inflation to produce gravity waves that are observable in the near future, then you necessarily need at least Planckian field range for the inflaton field. So yeah, this is what basically the length band is. And here, I think you've noticed that for inflation, I'm assuming a rather simple, single field, slow roll type inflation. So you may wonder what happens if you complicate the early universe, if you start considering more complicated early universe scenarios. But the thing is that it has been considered that if you just complicate the early universe, you just make the situation worse. And this is because, for example, if you consider like a non-slow roll inflation, then you end up enhancing the density perturbations. You end up producing larger density perturbations than this. So you end up suppressing the tensor to scalar ratio. So this relation turns into like an inequality like this. So the bound becomes even stronger. And the same is, the story is the same, even if you simply add like extra sources for the density perturbations. If you add like extra like ingredients to generate the density perturbations, again, you just enhance the scalar perturbations, so you make the situation worse. And the essence of this length bound is this part. The fact that the inflaton field fluctuations lead to the denser perturbations, this is the essence of the length bound because, well, since the inflaton field fluctuations necessarily produce some amount of denser perturbations, that suppresses the tensor to scalar ratio, and therefore it's very difficult to obtain a large R unless you have a very large inflaton velocity, or in other words, a very large inflaton field excursion. And when you think about it, this is rather trivial because, as I said, this inflaton field is, like, by definition, it's the field that controls the duration of inflation. So if this field fluctuates, that means that the duration of inflation is inhomogeneous. And so, of course, you end up with some amount of density perturbations. And there are no way that, I mean, it has been considered that once these density perturbations are produced, there's no way to get rid of it. And therefore, the generated density perturbations always suppresses the tensor to scalar ratio. And that's why this length bound has been considered to be a very robust prediction of inflation. And it sometimes was even referred to as like one of the consistency relations of inflation. If you have a non-canonical scalar field, there's actually a sound speed here. So unless you have like superluminal propagation, if you have a sound speed smaller than one, then you enhance the scalar perturbations. So it makes the situation worse.
Mm-hmm. So the inhomogeneities would have to be within that field displacement, mm-hmm. if you want to see that. Is that what you are considering, or are they out of the larger than those scales?
The inhomogeneities that I'm talking about is the ones that we actually see in the CMB scales.
So within the whole.
Yeah. Exactly. So in that sense, this e-folding number, to be precise, this doesn't have to be the total e-folding number. It can only correspond to the e-folding number during the CMB scales. But if you take this to be 10 instead of 50, it doesn't really change the story that much.
But for R, you do want N to be close to the largest horizon, to the largest scales that we can see, because those are the measurements that give you the best constraint on R.
Yeah.
So you want N to be around 50 at the time that you're measuring R.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't measure anything.
Yeah, but here you're only talking about, well, in the precise sense, this is inflaton field excursion while this R is taking this specific value. So it corresponds to at least the 10 e-foldings that we observe. Okay, so this is a length bound. But now I'm going to point out that this length bound, I mean, when you have extra degrees of freedom, which also contribute to the density perturbations, then there exist some special cases where you can get rid of this inflaton contribution to the density perturbations. So that's what I'm going to point out now. Okay, so I wouldn't say it's that. It's just that, let me see. I'm not saying it's bad or something, you know? I'm just saying that this is a strong kind of a restriction that restricts the model space to a very small class of models. But I'm just going to point out that you can actually go beyond this. So I'm going to point out that you can have large gravitational waves even from sub-Plankin inflation models.
I guess the argument is that if it's super Plankian, then you don't trust it because you don't understand quantum gravity.
But it's the field itself larger than capacity. It doesn't mean that the energy scale is larger.
I mean, of course, technically,
it's a pragmatic observation, not a fundamental one.
Yes, that is.
Usually, when people try to do this, they get in trouble. Not that all possible things.
But consider you have a condensed matter system and you describe it with a single field. Then it is very easy to put larger than flux field.
Sure.
Is it? I think so.
Yeah. You can have this macroscopic quantum effects. We'll have this long-range correlation. Field itself becomes very large.
Maybe the better way of expressing light bomb is not really delta phi, because delta phi is not invariant under the definition of fields or redefining your theory. There is like a combination of, it's the ratio of higher order terms in your perturbative Lagrangian to lower order terms. And like for single canonical scale, it shows up as delta phi, but in general, it's that kind. Whatever
that ratio is that shows up in light bomb. And like in this particular simple case, it's going to be like delta phi, and if it's super Planckian, maybe the effective field will be based on. Well, I guess at least, I think it's related to what you pointed out, but naively, you know, you would imagine that it would be difficult to suppress like higher order corrections. If the field starts moving beyond Planckian field ranges, and that makes it more challenging to build these kind of models. But I guess different people have different opinions on how bad or good these super Planckian things are. But as I'm going to point out, the inflaton field doesn't necessarily have to be Planckian, so it will change the story a bit. Okay, so.
Normally, if you think about from the effective field theory standpoint, and you write powers of, you write a potential that's sort of power of phi squared plus power of phi cubed plus power of phi to the fourth, etc., with the coefficient of some order one thing over an appropriate power of n Planck, then you know that potential typically has curves on a scale comparable to n Planck or shorter if the cutoff you put in there is less than n Planck, so
that's,
you know, look for a very flat portion of potential. Usually, it doesn't last for longer than.
But that's in a fundamental level. So what I'm thinking is like in a classical level, we consider something like a magnet. Okay, so when you have all the atoms spin pointing in one direction, you describe the whole thing with one field. That means the value of this field. So.
That's the Lorentz invariant system, isn't it?
Well,
I think supergravity is a classical example where you represent the slime. The field to be arbitrary is large, costs you no energy at all, and there's nothing all that effective. But like you're saying, if they have a potential, the issue is how fast does the potential climb the field from them? Generically, when you make these models, they climb. So.
Yeah, but
So if you have a symmetry, then all of these, I guess, arguments that that's you. Because then you would have symmetry breaking parameters of the system. So I guess the assumption is that there is no symmetry, so all the higher order operators are suppressed by the cutoff, and the cutoff should be less than that. But if you have a symmetry, then that's not correct.
Okay, so now I want to point out that when you have additional fields, there are special cases where you can suppress the inflaton contribution to the scalar perturbations. And as I said, if that happens, you can basically get rid of the Lyth bound out of the inflaton sector. And in order to see that, I'm going to consider a simple toy model case where there's only two fields. One field is the inflaton field, which is basically the field that controls duration of inflation. And another field, sigma, which is a spectator field, in the sense that it has minimal effect on the inflation expansion, but somehow contributes to the production of the density perturbations after inflation. So technically speaking, you could imagine this sigma field to be something like a curvaton or a modulus in the modulated reheating. But anyway, for the moment, we can just consider this to be an arbitrary field that is negligible during inflation, but somehow starts to produce density perturbations after inflation. Okay, so in order to see, let me just first explain how this works. So as I said, if the inflaton field fluctuates, it means that the duration of inflation is slightly different among different patches of the universe. So you end up with some amount of density perturbations at the end of inflation. So, and that leads to this Lyth bound. But when you have this additional field sigma, this means that there's among different patches of the universe, there's slightly more or less time for this sigma field to evolve during inflation. And therefore, the field value of the sigma field becomes slightly inhomogeneous at the end of inflation. And therefore, the post-inflationary expansion history starts from slightly different initial conditions. And therefore, the post-inflationary expansion also becomes slightly inhomogeneous. So in this sense, the inflaton field fluctuations end up producing density perturbations not only during inflation, but after inflation. And note here that these two contributions come from the same inflaton field fluctuations. So if they have the same amplitude with the opposite sign, then they can cancel each other. And so that's like the basic picture. Okay, so let's actually see that. So I'm going to basically compute the density perturbations in this two-field system. And upon doing that, I'm going to invoke something called delta n formalism, which is a useful technique for computing density perturbations in a system. So in this delta n formalism, the density perturbations, which I denote by zeta, can be identified as the inhomogeneities in the e-folding number. And this e-folding number is defined as the log of the scale factor from some initial time to the final time. And here I'm going to take the initial hypersurface to be the time when the CMB scales exit the horizon during inflation. And the final time can be taken as an arbitrary time in the future after which no extra density perturbations are produced. So you can rewrite this as an integral of the Hubble parameter from the initial time to the final time. Or you can also consider this whole e-folding number to be a function of the field values of phi and sigma on the initial hypersurface, I mean at the time when the CMB scales exit the horizon. So if you consider this in this way, you can basically expand this delta n in terms of the field fluctuations of the field up to linear order. So if you write it in this way, then you can compute the power spectrum. You can express the power spectrum of zeta in terms of the power spectrum of the field fluctuations. And here I'm assuming that these two fields do not have direct couplings. So therefore, the field fluctuation of the two fields don't have any correlations. So you only get the contribution from the power spectrum of the from the individual fields. And of course, I mean, as I said at the beginning, the field fluctuations of the fields are set by the inflationary Hubble parameter. Okay. So now this whole problem of computing the denser perturbations simply reduces to the problem of computing how the total E-folding number depends on the initial field values. So for calculating that, let me expand this E-folding number in terms of the inflationary E-folding number and the post-inflationary E-folding number. So this T of n corresponds to the time when inflation ends. So I'll call this inflationary E-folding number as n of a, and this post-inflationary E-folding number as n of b. And for this inflationary E-folding number, which is this, the inflaton field is like the clock field. So you can rewrite this integration in terms of the inflaton field, the integration over the inflaton field. Like this. And for the post-inflationary E-folding number, you can consider this to be a function of the field values at the end of inflation. But the field value of the inflaton field at the end of inflation is normally, this is normally a constant. This is because normally inflation ends when the inflaton field approaches a steep part along its energy potential. And then it just, you know, rolls off and inflation ends. So this phi n is basically a constant, a field value, which is whose value is set by the form of the effective potential. So this can be considered to be a constant. So now, keeping this in mind, oh yeah, if you consider like more complicated models like inhomogeneous end of inflation, yes. But here the sigma field it's defined to be a spectator field, in the sense that it doesn't have direct couplings with the inflaton, and it's like its energy density is negligibly tiny, so it doesn't affect the inflation expansion. So in this sense, phi n is like a.
It does become important at some point.
Yeah, after inflation, but here this phi n is like the field value at the end of inflation, so. It doesn't depend on phi on sigma. Okay. I'm sorry.
Are you using prompt reheating or some time of oscillations?
Here I'm not assuming anything. I'll talk about more explicit examples involving those kind of things. But here, reheating happens just sometime between the end of inflation and after inflation.
And
so the basic picture is that the inflaton just, so maybe the inflaton field has a potential like this. And when it comes to this steep part, inflation ends.
And sigma n is also the value of the band field at the same time.
At the end of inflation, exactly. Okay. So keeping this in mind, we can compute the derivatives of n in terms of phi star and sigma star. So if you want to compute the first derivative, the derivative of n in terms of phi star, from the first contribution from Na, you get this. Because phi n is a constant, you only get the contribution from the lower end of integration. And from the post-inflationary E-folding number, you get this extra contribution. But here, let me add this sigma in here. So this is the This is a normal inflaton contribution to the density perturbations. It corresponds to the inflaton producing density perturbations during inflation. So if you don't have the spectator field, this term is absent, and you just recover this familiar form. But here, since you have this additional spectator field, the inflaton field fluctuates the spectator field and produces extra density perturbations after inflation. So this is a new contribution here. And if you do a derivative of, in terms of the sigma star, the sigma star is a, I mean, the sigma field is a spectator field, so it doesn't affect the inflationary e-folding number, and it only affects the post-inflationary e-folding number. So you only get a contribution like from the second term. Okay. So now the whole problem reduces to simply computing how the sigma field value at the end of inflation depends on the initial field values. And for doing that, all you have to do is to solve the equation of motion for the sigma field. So this is a Klein-Gordon equation for the sigma field, and where V of sigma is the effective potential for sigma. But if the sigma field is a light field, then you can basically use a slow roll approximation and ignore the acceleration term. Then the whole thing is a first-order differential equation. So you can rewrite it like this. And if you integrate this from the initial hypersurface to the end of inflation, now you can rewrite this right-hand side in terms of the clock field phi. You get something like this. So now if you do a derivative of both sides in terms of phi star, from the left-hand side you get and from the right-hand side you get and if you do a derivative of both sides in terms of sigma star, you get but from the right-hand side is it's basically determined by the inflationary dynamics. So the spectator field doesn't affect this right-hand side. So this right-hand side gives a zero. So now we've got all the ingredients we need. So using this relation, we can basically compute this. And now we can substitute these into these relations in order to compute the power spectrum for the density perturbations. So if you substitute this expression into here, you can compute the inflaton contribution to the density perturbations. And let me rewrite this like this. So here, this kappa is a parameter which I defined by so this basically tells you it's proportional to the sigma field contribution to the density perturbations. So if I use the slow roll approximation, I can rewrite this in terms of the sigma field velocity. So now, as I said, if there's no spectator field and if there's only one inflaton field, then this Kappa parameter is zero. So in that case, this is zero, and you just recover the normal inflaton contribution to the density perturbations. But because of the existence of the sigma field, now the inflaton field is generating density perturbations also after inflation, and that is represented by this kappa parameter. And I think you can see that in the special case where this kappa parameter is equal to 1, then the inflaton contribution to the density perturbations vanish. This becomes 0. And this corresponds to the very non-trivial case where the inflaton field is fluctuating and the duration of inflation is inhomogeneous. However, the inflaton field generates additional density perturbations after inflation such that it cancels out the density perturbations that it produced during inflation. And therefore, the inflaton field is leaving zero trace in the final density perturbations.
Assuming there are no couplings.
No, there are no couplings.
So the slow roll of the two fields should be independent.
Mm-hmm. But the duration of inflation is affected by the field fluctuations.
What do you mean the duration of inflation? Do you mean the 10 first defoldings, or do you mean does the curvaton give some inflation afterwards?
The duration, I mean, the time from when the CMB scales exited the horizon until the end of inflation.
Curvaton does not give inflation afterwards, it
no.
just gives the perturbations.
Exactly.
So how do you get the contribution of sigma, of phi to slow roll to be dependent on the contribution of sigma to slow roll?
So basically the sigma end is the field value at the end of inflation. So by definition, it depends on the duration of inflation, right? Because when inflation ends, is determined by this, and when inflation ends is determined by this phi star, and the sigma end depends on the length of inflation, and therefore it affects the sigma field value. So it's all gravitational effects. It doesn't come from the direct coupling, but it comes from the in a sense, it comes from the gravitational couplings.
I can ask you afterwards. I don't want to interrupt too much.
So, okay.
You had a line on K very close to 1 the other day.
You're exactly, yeah.
You
so
are?
You are.
Yeah, so I'm going to consider the case where kappa becomes close to 1. And it may look like a fine tuning, but I'll also present an example where kappa always goes to 1.
How close to 1 does it have to get?
So, it all depends on how much the original thing is. If this is like much larger than the double map normalization, then you want kappa to be close enough to 1 such that this becomes smaller than the observed amplitude. That answers your question.
We'll see what your model is.
So I'm just repeating this, but in the case where kappa goes to 1, then the inflaton contribution to the density perturbations vanish, and the life bound will be removed from the inflaton sector. So let's see that. So let me write the generalized form of the life bound. So I've already written the form for the power spectrum for the density perturbations up there. And the power spectrum for the tensor perturbations is well, it's basically set by the inflationary Hubble parameter, but something like this. So if you combine these things, you can obtain the life bound for the two fields. So first of all, for the inflaton field, I'm sorry? This the denominator, or? Oh, this is just the power spectrum of the tensor perturbations is 2 times the Hubble parameter squared over pi squared. It's a pi, I'm sorry. Okay, so this is a quantity that represents how much the inflaton field evolves in 1 Hubble time during inflation relative to the Planck scale. So you can substitute this here, this relation here, and this corresponds to the inflaton contribution to the density perturbation power spectrum. So you can rewrite this in terms of all these parameters. So this P of zeta is the power spectrum for the total density perturbations. And this P of zeta phi is the inphoton contribution to the power spectrum. So this is always larger than 1, so we get a lower bound, which looks like this. And for similarly, you can compute the field range for the spectator field. You get a lower bound that looks like this. So this is like the generalized form of the light band. So as I said, if there's no spectator field and if there's only the single inphoton field, then this kappa parameter is zero. So this just turns into R over 8, and you recover the familiar light bound, basically telling you that the inphoton field excursion is bounded from below by the tensor to scalar ratio. However, in the special case where kappa goes to 1, which corresponded to the case where the inphoton contribution to the density perturbation vanishes, in that case, you can see that the light bound disappears from the inphoton sector and now shows up in the spectator field sector. So this is the general result of my talk today. Yeah. So as I said at the beginning, this light band still holds for the total field space. Yeah. So in that sense, it opens a possibility for model building. But for the Plankin thing, there's still this same problem. I mean, I don't know whether it's a problem, but there's this.
But I mean, if you say that super Plankin field is not kosher, then you still have problems. Because that was the philosophy of the light band. You don't have a special symmetry, then mm-hmm. Your field doesn't should be less than a cutoff.
Yeah.
And then it seems that your inphoton moves less than a cutoff, but your periphoton does more.
Mm-hmm. So as I said at the beginning, my message here is that large R still means some super Plankin something, mm-hmm. but it does not necessarily mean the super Plankin inphoton. That's the main message. Oh, this is P of zeta phi.
But they have the same.
This is a P of delta phi. I'm sorry. So this is a field fluctuations of order the Hubble parameter. Okay. So this is general result of which can basically apply for any sort of a multi-field early universe scenario. But now, to get a better feeling, I'm going to point out and present an explicit example where kappa always goes to 1 and you end up getting rid of the light band from the inphoton sector. So this can happen in a curvaton example. So okay, so here I'm plotting the log scale of energy densities versus the log of the scale factor. Okay, so for the inphoton sector, the energy density of the inphoton field is more or less constant during inflation, but after inflation, it may undergo like harmonic oscillations around its local minimum, then its energy density drops like proportional to 1 over the volume. And then if it decays into radiation, it drops even quicker, proportional to the scale factor to the minus 4. But if this inphoton field fluctuates, it means that the duration of inflation is different among different patches of the universe. So in some patch of the universe, it could be like like this. Okay. Now, a curvaton is a field that only has negligible energy density during inflation, but comes to dominate the universe after inflation and produces density perturbations. And it's considered to be a light field. So initially, it only has its energy density is more or less constant because it's moving very slowly and its energy density is more or less constant. But now in the normal curvaton scenario, the curvaton is considered to start its oscillation after inflation. But in this specific example, I'm going to consider the case where the curvaton starts its oscillation during inflation. And this can happen if, for example, if the curvaton has like an inflection type potential. So in this case, the curvaton may be rolling along a flat plateau very slowly, but rolling during inflation. But if it approaches the steep part during inflation, then it will just start to oscillate. Yeah. So in this case, the story will be a little bit modified, but the basic picture is the same. Okay, so in this case, the curvaton starts its oscillation during inflation. So after it starts its oscillation, its energy density registers proportional to one over the volume. And so if this curvaton has a long lifetime, then if you wait long enough, even if the initial energy density of the curvaton is negligible, it eventually comes to dominate the universe like this, until this curvaton also decays into radiation. Okay. So now here the point is that once the curvaton starts its oscillation, its energy density registers proportional to one over the volume independently of how the universe is expanding, no matter whether the universe is inflating or not. Oh. Uh-huh. So like forming something like oscillons, right?
Yeah, just fragments and now it's all
nonlinear. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I knew that you're gonna ask that question. And the answer is that whether it fragments or not doesn't change the story that much, because even if it fragments, it acts like matter, so its energy density drops like one over the volume.
Going to be the density fluctuations that are adiabatic to the structure?
It will suppress the fluctuations by the inflaton, and it will also produce the observed density perturbations. So in that case, all it matters is how this curvaton energy density redshifts. And so as long as it dominates the universe eventually, it does its job. So whether it's oscillating or whether it fragments and form oscillons, in a similar fashion, once it starts its oscillation, its energy density drops like one over the volume. So the story is the same.
If the fragmentation happens long enough before the end of inflation that it maps onto observational scales, isn't that a problem? So there's some constraint that it has to stay constant at least long enough that these things map onto unobservable scales.
I see. So I'm assuming that the CMB scales exit the horizon during this stage. So the oscillation happens before inflation, but after the CMB scales exit the horizon.
Why are you making it more massive? You have to make it oscillate for so long. So if you ask it to oscillate earlier, you're making it more massive, right? The curvaton, you're making it.
It's not the mass, it depends on when this field approaches the steep part.
Yeah, it will start to oscillate at the time that the mass equals the Hubble rate.
No. Because during inflation, the Hubble parameter is a constant, right? So this kind of thing doesn't happen if you have a simple quantitative potential. And that's why I'm considering an inflection type, yeah.
And you're doing it on purpose, that's for what you're about to say.
Yeah. Because I want the curvaton to start its oscillation during inflation.
Okay.
That's why I'm drawing here rather kind of an artificial potential.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But anyway, the point is that once the curvaton starts the oscillation, its energy density just redshifts proportional to one over the volume, independently of how the universe expands. So in this sense, this curvaton field cannot notice that the end of inflation was slightly different among different patches of the universe. In other words, this curvaton doesn't know that the universe underwent inhomogeneous inflationary expansions. So as this curvaton field dominates the universe, it kind of washes out the density perturbations produced from the inflaton field. So, I'm just repeating what I just said, but as the energy density of the curvaton field comes to dominate the universe, the inflaton contribution to the density perturbations vanish, or in other words, the kappa goes to 1. So in this case, the kappa parameter is proportional to the inverse of this energy density ratio, plus 1. Okay. So in other words, as this curvaton field doesn't feel the inhomogeneities in the inflationary expansion, as this field, as this component comes to dominate the universe, it just washes out all the memory that the universe underwent inhomogeneous inflationary expansion.
Can you see in that definition of kappa how it becomes one? Because it sounds like somehow based on what you're plotting there, we should see that definition is one, and I don't see it.
So
it's using slow roll formulas.
Dominated by the slow roll of the curvaton.
The slow roll formulas have to be failing.
So I shouldn't look at that definition, or?
Well, it's. I mean, you have to modify that formalism slightly in order to apply it to this thing, but still, the intuitive explanation is just what I said, in the sense that, you know, if this comes to dominate the universe, I mean, since this doesn't notice this fact, it washes out the memory of the inflaton contribution to the density perturbations. And that's why, as this comes to dominate the universe, where did I write? The del dn over d phi goes to 0. And that corresponds to kappa going to 1. And you can actually compute this whole thing for this model. And it turns out that kappa turns to be like a function of 1 plus a term that is inversely proportional to this energy density ratio.
Here, partly because you're using the slow roll approximation everywhere.
All the way.
And then you're saying that you're actually not going to, that's not the example you're thinking about, you've got a completely different thing you're going to analyze.
It's not completely different.
But it's different in the sense that you're really relying on, I completely accept that you can have another field dominate and wash out in the original fluctuation the way you're doing it. But it would have been very difficult to see it in the formalism that you were describing originally.
But it's not that different because all these things hold until it starts to oscillate. So you just have to add this slight modification.
The business end of this thing is really never covered by the slow roll approximation.
I mean, it's covered until this point.
Yeah, but that's when nothing interesting is happening. And all the thing that's making you do what you want to do is after that point.
Let me see.
But the observable scales have already left the horizon at that time. So they're outside the horizon. Even the delta n, delta sigma contribution.
But if you, well, the point is that you want to compute how the sigma field evolved, starting from this initial field value. And in this case, here upon computing how sigma evolves, I just use a slow roll approximation and solve the equation of motion from the initial time until the end of inflation. But here instead, you have to do that from the initial time until it starts to oscillate and compute this extra thing. So in that sense, it's not that different.
Well, I think, if I understand you right, I agree that you can justify the delta n formalism because things are happening after the horizon exit.
Yeah, exactly.
That part of it I agree with. But the dynamics that's giving you the domination of this later, this field later is all about the non-slow roll part of it. Right? And so the formulas with 1 minus k's over there are kind of not so useful in the sense that when we actually do the analysis down here,
It also depends on the fact that the rolling during this stage is not really affected by phi star. Because here you can basically use a slower approximation, but the Hubble parameter is more or less constant. So the Hubble friction that is constantly slowing down the Smith field doesn't depend on phi star. And also, when it starts its oscillation, is also, it's just fixed by the form of the sigma field potential. So in that sense, not only this part, but this part is also independent of the phi field dynamics. So that's also important for this thing.
Doesn't it exist a model with a Pearson role for everybody where k goes to 1 and sits there?
So the sigma field is slow rolling until the end of inflation and still kappa goes to 1. Originally I was looking into those cases, and that can happen for some complicated curveton examples. I found an example like that. But in order for that to happen, you have to really tune things. And instead here, it's more easy because all you have to do is the curveton to dominate the universe. So that's why I like this example more. But at least if you tune things, you can have these kind of examples, even in a full slow rolling case. Okay. So this is an example. And let me just add a comment on the comparison with the normal curveton case. So for the normal curveton, as was questioned, the normal curveton has a simple quadratic potential. And so it starts to oscillate when its mass becomes comparable to the Hubble parameter. So in that case, the energy density would be something like this, and then it starts to oscillate. And but in this case, this kind of thing normally doesn't happen because the time it starts its oscillation is determined by when the Hubble parameter becomes comparable to its mass. Well, the Hubble parameter is set by the energy density of the inphoton, which is inhomogeneous. Therefore, the time when the curveton starts its oscillation also becomes inhomogeneous. So therefore, when the curveton starts its oscillation, it picks up information that the universe underwent inhomogeneous inflationary expansion. So that's why in normal curveton, these kind of things does not happen. But as I said, if the curveton starts its oscillation during inflation, then the story becomes different. Okay, so let me wrap up. So today I pointed out that when there's additional degree of freedom, which also contribute to the reduction of the density perturbations, then there exist some special cases where the density perturbations produced from the inphoton can be washed away. And I think that has a couple of interesting implications for cosmology, and among which the thing that I focused on today was that when that happens, you can basically, the life bound disappears from the inphoton sector and shows up in this non-inphoton sector. And so therefore, it opens up the possibility of producing large gravitation waves, even from small field inflation models. Even though, but still, as I pointed out, the life bound holds for the total field space. So you still need some super Planckian something. And as an explicit example, I presented this kind of a curveton example. So that's pretty much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's sigma.
Because
the
lifebound now shows up in sigma.
Can we use this k to be continuous? Is your derivation only valid for the curveton limit, or can we phrase the whole thing in terms of a fraction of inflaton and curveton contribution to the power spectrum? Like you have, when you specified your power spectrum as having an inflaton and curveton contribution, you have there the delta n, delta phi, delta n, delta sigma.
Mm-hmm.
Can we, so is your formalism only valid in one or the other regime, or can we use that continuously throughout?
Yeah, here I didn't assume anything about the ratio between the contributions from the two fields. So it can apply for any.
So
case.
We could take K as it is normally defined in the literature and consider it to be between 0 and 1.
I'm sorry, you mean?
K is. Your k could be related to the
fraction. So you're basically talking about the ratio between the curve, the sigma field contribution and the inflaton. Yeah, so those can take any value here.
If there are no more questions, then let's take the Q&A.